Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of February 14th, 2014. It's Valentine's Day weekend, where maybe buried under dinner reservations and last-minute flower purchases, we tend to take stock of our relationships, appreciate and evaluate them. We're going to do that today on the financial front. Is our romance with Bitcoin a flash in the pan? How about taxes? That's a long-term relationship. We're going to start, though, with the Affordable Care Act, because we're getting a clearer picture of how consumers feel about the plans offered under the law. More than 1 million people enrolled in plans on state or federal exchanges in January, bringing the overall total enrolled in exchange plans to 3.3 million. Dan Gorenstein covers healthcare for Marketplace and is here to break down the numbers for us. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
We've gotten the latest update from the Obama administration about how many people are enrolling in the Affordable Care Act. What is the story that those numbers are telling you?
Here's a number that really hit me, Lizzie. 62. That's the percent of people who've picked a silver or sort of a mid-tier plan. And what that tells me is that customers right out of the gate are interested in having a product that really provides some level of coverage. Like only 19% have chosen a bronze plan, which is sort of more of a bare bones thing. Mm-hmm. Now, part of this reason is that there might be more of a federal subsidy at the silver level. And maybe the people who are enrolling are sicker. We don't have that information yet. But one thing to watch, Lizzie, over the next 6 weeks is whether the last-minute shoppers are going to flock to a more basic and cheaper plans.
Because people can enroll until March 31st, so we sort of want to see what that last-minute group of people, what kind of plan they go for.
That's right.
The other part of this question, now that we're getting toward the end of the enrollment period, people are starting to have some actual experience with being insured under this law. What are they finding in terms of how useful the networks of doctors and plans are to them?
Consumers have to really pay attention to what kind of plan they're buying, Lizzie, because a lot of the plans that the insurance companies are offering have what are called narrow networks, which are really sort of a limited choice of doctors and hospitals. And so if you already have a doctor or a hospital you'd like to go to, you need to make sure that your plan that you're buying, your new plan, is in fact covering your doctor and the hospital of choice. And so what we're seeing in these first 6 weeks is we're seeing some consumers buy these plans and then kind of go, my doctor's not covered. And so there are enough of these stories out there that the Obama administration has recently announced that consumers have until the end of March to pick a new plan as long as it's with the same insurer and the same tier like gold or bronze if they really want to kind of have a wider network or make sure that their doctor is in fact covered.
So putting a little more maneuverability in there, maybe.
That's right. And, you know, consumers, I think everybody sort of recognizes that there needs to be, in year one, some degree of flexibility here. This is a very complicated thing. People are trying to figure it out. And let's be honest, the insurers want this to work for consumers. The federal government wants this to work for consumers. So everybody's trying to tweak the edges to make sure that people are getting the best health insurance plan possible.
All right, let's get into one of the interesting philosophical questions here. A report from the Congressional Budget Office that came out saying the equivalent of more than 2 million full-time jobs could be lost due to the Affordable Care Act. And this is one of those statistics that just sort of blows up in Washington. But let's explain it, because any big social welfare program creates incentives, disincentives. Break it down for us. What does that mean in terms of how it influences how people choose to work?
One of the unfortunate things about the Affordable Care Act is it's so politicized, it's really kind of sometimes hard to make the forest for the trees. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on consumers to really kind of figure out what's going on when they hear little snips and snaps of news here and there. But I think that what the CBO found is that basically, by having an alternative, you know, most of us get insurance through our jobs. But now because you've got the Affordable Care Act in place, people can go on and shop in these exchanges. You don't actually have to have work. You don't have to have a job to get insurance. So there's an affordable way to get coverage. And so what the CBO found is that Americans will voluntarily leave the labor force. And that's the key word, voluntarily leave, either cut back on the hours or get out of it entirely because they've just, you know, they're 62 years old and they've been hanging on to this job forever.
Or to qualify for some of those subsidies to come in at, say, a lower income point and get a little help from the federal government.
Precisely. So, and it, look, it must be said that the CBO is not, this is new ground. They're not sure. They're definitely hedging their bets here. But one economist wrote that if anything, the people who choose to leave the workforce, what that ultimately does is it opens up other opportunities for all these people who are graduating from school and looking to get their foot in the door. And potentially, you know, the old heads leaving creates a new opportunity for these young whippersnappers.
Dan Gorenstein, who covers healthcare for us from WHYY in Philadelphia, thank you so much.
Lizzie, thank you.
We are a little over 1 month into the Affordable Care Act's coverage going live. It's a big law and it touches all Americans in one way or another. We want to know what you're experiencing. Did your insurance situation change? Have you used the exchanges? Good, bad, anywhere in between? We want to hear from you. Let us know at marketplacemoney.org. You can send us an email, leave us a voicemail, and sign up to be part of the community where you can connect with other listeners. You can also find us on Facebook or on the Twitters at LiveMoney. This is Marketplace Money from APM. It has not been a great week for Bitcoin. Hackers hit two exchanges that customers use, which meant some of them couldn't get their money out. And the value of the cryptocurrency dropped to its lowest level in 2 months, as much as 6% on Tuesday alone. So what does all this mean if you've put a little money in Bitcoin? Or want to? Or are wondering why anybody would? We're joined now by the host of Marketplace Tech, Ben Johnson, to help us sort it all out. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie.
This feels like one bad headline after another for Bitcoin. How serious is this for people who are interested in investing or using Bitcoin?
Well, I think it is serious. I mean, there have been some headlines that I'll tell you about. I think I will say that this is part of growing pains of any technology, any currency like this that's unregulated. The issue here is Mt. Gox, or Mt. Gox, depending on what you want to call it. It used to be a magic card trading site and then became a sort of Bitcoin exchange slash bank, a way for you to store and to withdraw Bitcoin into cash.
So we think of this as the Bitcoin bank.
Sure. And the issue here is that Mt. Gox had this problem with its withdrawal system. There was a problem basically where the site was having trouble properly tracking and accounting for transactions. So, for instance, as a user, I could make two withdrawals and Mt. Gox would think that it was one withdrawal and I could withdraw twice as much money.
And this has sort of psychological consequences, too. I mean, yes, it's high tech, but at the heart of it, it's kind of like an old-fashioned bank run.
Absolutely. And this is the problem. I mean, Mt. Gox sort of shut down its withdrawal system. Users freaked out. People were really upset. They felt like the company could have fixed this problem earlier, and they didn't fix it. So this is bad news for Mt. Gox. Mt. Gox is one of the sort of original places where you can withdraw, exchange Bitcoin. But there are lots of other options. There's Coinbase. There's, you know, other companies that do some of the same things. And this will probably drive a lot of users to those places.
So let's step back a little bit here. Why do people invest in Bitcoin to begin with?
I think there's basically two reasons that people invest in Bitcoin. The first is philosophical. They like the idea that it doesn't have some of the same hurdles as other currency trading. So maybe not as many service charges as your credit card or less tax issues. Of course, that all might change if Bitcoin ever becomes actually regulated, which will be a problem for those tech philosophers. The other reason is that people are speculators. This is a currency that's very volatile. It will stay volatile until it's regulated. And thus, you can make a lot of money on it, and a lot of people have.
So one of the ideas here is that you could put in some money and run it up quickly. What kind of returns do people get if they do that?
Oof. Crazy returns. I mean, I've talked to people who bought Bitcoin at $12 a coin and sold at $1,000 a coin.
For the people who are listening to this who say, all right, listen, this is way too science fiction-y for me. I'm not going to do this. Why does this matter to me? How does it fit into a broader structure of how we think about money and how we use money?
Well, first of all, I would say Bitcoin is like any other form of currency. It's a massive hallucination that we all decide to agree upon, right? That this has value, it has worth, and we can trade it for goods and services. So I think that the potential for Bitcoin or other currencies like it is that this could be a new way for us to do transactions online and in person. I've talked to people who buy their gas with Bitcoin, who buy their food with Bitcoin at the farmer's market. I mean, it could be this kind of new and amazingly simple way for us to use and transfer money online. But it's going to take a little while for it to get to that point because there's still a lot of skepticism and, you know, governments are wondering about it.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Are you getting into the world of alternative currencies? If so, we want to know about your experience. Tweet us and interact with other listeners at Live Money. Here at Marketplace Money, we love to explore how the world of money impacts you. If you've got questions about your finances, visit us at marketplacemoney.org. There, you can leave us a voicemail or shoot us an email. Coming up, straight talk plus wisdom. Personal finance expert Liz Weston joins me to answer your money questions.
College educations are just going to become more and more important. Just to stay in the middle class, people are going to need to have a college degree. So that's kind of your starting point. That's something to think about, is that if you can save for your kids' college education, you probably should. People think, oh, I'm going to save and ruin their chances of financial aid. Well, financial aid is mostly loans. So by saving, you're helping your child have less debt. That's all a good thing.
And later in the show, a conversation for all the lovers.
Whenever we talk about money and love and romance, things can get difficult. There's always the cheapskate in the relationship, and there's the one that racks up the credit card bills. We're always talking about, how do you bring up debt in a relationship? How do you bring up a prenuptial agreement in a relationship?
On Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. So this is the part of the show where we like to open up the phones, answer your questions, and here to help us out is Liz Weston. She is a personal finance expert and the author of The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Lizzie.
So our first caller is Kate. She's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Map out your scenario for me. I understand that you've got three kids, and you're in a same-sex relationship, but in a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage.
Exactly. Yes. I am a stay-at-home mom to three boys, ages 2, 6, and 8. And I have, about 10 years ago, talked to a financial advisor who suggested, as a way of helping me save for retirement, to have whole life insurance. Because I couldn't have a spousal Roth and I am not working, so I couldn't have any kind of employer IRA. And 10 years later, I have kind of wondered if that's still a plan or if there's a better option for me to be saving for retirement that would have some tax benefits.
Well, let me ask you before we sort of get into that. I know Liz has some thoughts on this, but in terms of your broader picture, what's your savings picture look like right now as a couple? And you're also considering maybe going back to school, right?
Right. As my youngest is getting older, I'm planning to probably go back to school to get a master's degree. And I was also wanting some advice on paying for that. As a couple, we're doing okay. I don't think we're probably as great as some people or as bad off as others. So we're right in the middle there, I think. We have the typical, you know, checking, savings. I have an old IRA from when I did work. We pay into her retirement account at work, plus this life insurance policy that I've had now for 10 years.
Liz, what are your thoughts about Kate's situation?
Anytime I hear that a whole life policy has been sold to a middle-income person, I flinch because a lot of times there are better options. It's not that there's anything necessarily wrong with the policy that you got, but it's more expensive than a plain old term policy that would have just, you know, which you need anyway because you have kids. And if something happened to you, you would, you know, your partner would have to hire someone to take care of the kids. So life insurance is definitely appropriate. It's the idea of having a cash value policy, something that has an investment component, that makes me a little twitchy. Now, I'm not going to say it was a bad call, but you can always just set up a brokerage account and put money in it and earmark it for retirement. And if you hold on to those investments for at least a year, you benefit from the lower capital gains tax rate. So it's not like you get, you know, a discount for putting your money in, but you don't get that with a life insurance policy either. So sometimes the tax benefits of these policies are really touted when they don't talk as much about the expenses of these policies, which tend to be fairly high. So long story short, what I would recommend with that particular policy is find yourself a fee-only financial planner. This is someone who is compensated only by the fees you pay, who doesn't get a commission for selling products. Have this person look at your policy and see, is it worth keeping? Should we exchange it for something that's a better deal? Because you can do these exchanges, one policy for another. What are my other options for saving for retirement? It could be that you've got the best deal and you just go with it, but I would really like to see an expert have another set of eyes on your situation.
Okay. In terms of that, too, then if I needed to get term life insurance at that point, if I was getting rid of my whole, then I'm, you know, 10, 12 years older than I was when I originally got the policy. So will that negatively affect, like, the cost of the policy anyway?
How old are you, Kate? Can I ask you?
38 now.
Hey,
still young.
So am I. Cool.
No, but that's a very good question, and that may be the reason why you would hang on to the policy you have now, particularly if any health issues have popped up, if there's a chronic disease or something like that. Then the fact that you have this permanent insurance could be a blessing because you've got the coverage, you don't have to worry about it. Kate, you're still relatively young. If you don't have health issues, it shouldn't be a problem for getting term insurance. But like I said, there may be a better option for you just switching this policy into another one. That's why you want to have an expert look at it.
Okay, that sounds good. Thanks.
Kate, tell me what you're interested in maybe going back to school for.
Probably getting my master's in social work. I have my bachelor's in social work, and I was wondering about how to pay for that. My kids have 529s, and I wasn't sure if it makes more sense to take money out of those to use to pay for my college or to go ahead and take student loans out myself. You know, the idea of losing the interest, the compounding interest of the 529s versus, you know, paying the interest of a student loan, I don't really know how that all shakes out.
Ms. Weston, how does it shake out?
I would take a step back. I want to make sure that this master's degree in social work is a good idea because there are a lot of master's degrees that sound good but don't really pay off. So the first thing I would do, Kate, is go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and kind of poke around, see what people with master's with social work are actually getting paid. Not to dissuade you from, you know, if this is something you feel passionate about, really want to do it, and in your area you need this degree, then, you know, by all means, charge ahead. But the problem is, if you're going to borrow money for this degree, it might not necessarily pay off. So you want to do a little research in advance and see, okay, what is this? You know, what am I actually going to get back? And that may help you decide, okay, if there's going to be a huge payoff, then borrowing money usually is, you know, not a bad idea. If you keep your borrowing to moderate levels, you don't want to borrow more for your total education than you expect to get paid in the first year out of school. You want to try to limit your borrowing to federal student loans only. And as a graduate student, you can borrow up to the total cost of your education. Now, as you know, probably, if you're borrowing money from the federal government and you're a graduate student, the interest rate's getting close to 8%. So there's where you have that dilemma of, do you take the money from the 529, which you obviously can. You just change the beneficiary. So you definitely can take the money out of there. The idea is, I assume, that you will, with your new job and new income, replenish that money as quickly as possible, right?
Exactly, yes. That would be the plan.
All right. Well, do some research first. Make sure that the education itself makes sense. And then you, too, have some talking to do because, you know, it's kind of nice not to have that debt. But if you are going to get a big payoff in terms of an increase in income, then sometimes taking on some debt can make sense. And if you can't decide, then maybe a 50-50 approach. Pay for half of it, borrow the other half. But you do want to take a look at your total financial situation. I want to make sure you guys are on track for saving for retirement. You know, that's got to come before paying for the kids' college in any case. And then if you do take money out of the 529, paying that back as quickly as you can would be a good idea for your kids, because college is not going to get any cheaper.
Sure isn't.
Yeah, this is sort of the put your emergency mask on before assisting the child next to you approach.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of parents have a tough time with that. You don't want to be having to move in with that kid, you know, when you run out of money in retirement.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Liz, I'm going to ask you to stick around because we are going to be back in a bit to take more questions from listeners.
You bet.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. My guest this hour is Liz Weston, and we're talking about your personal finance, taking your calls. Next, we're going to talk to Tom in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Tom.
Hey there. How you doing?
I am good. So congratulations are in order. I guess you are expecting your first baby.
Yeah, my wife, Vanessa, and I, and we're very excited.
I'm very excited for you, too.
Thank you.
But I gather the financial responsibility of this is weighing on you a little bit.
Well, yeah, you know, we're not, you know, weighing is not, you know, necessarily the, I don't mean to put it so negatively, but, you know, we definitely are, you know, trying to be very conscious and deliberate in the financial decisions we make going forward. You know, Vanessa's working on a project right now, and it basically is a year's worth of work, and she'll get a year's worth of salary at the conclusion of this project. So she will plans to finance, you know, her own maternity leave because she's a contract employee with this, but we also have, you know, depending on how the project ends up and, you know, how the budgets fall and everything, I think we could stand to pocket, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 of the money, or to not pocket, excuse me, but to save it in some
yeah,
way, shape, or
yeah.
form.
Let's back up a little bit. Tell me what
sure.
you guys do. And my understanding is that right now you don't have retirement savings.
That's correct. So right now she works as a fashion producer,
okay.
and I work as a web developer. I just actually am in the process right now of applying for a Roth IRA. And likewise, after I've been kind of speaking to my wife about it and kind of encouraging her to look into it, she's really begun to look seriously into a Roth IRA. She's actually looking at it when I left her this morning. We, you know, we both intend to start saving. And with that in mind, you know, I heard you say to the other caller, you know, you got to kind of put the life mask on yourself to breathe first and then give it to the baby. What can we do both for the child's own savings for college and whatnot in the future, but also things we can do to maybe create a child's expense fund to better maintain the budget that we set going forward.
And what kind of an income do you have coming in when you put your money together?
We have about $120,000 a year.
Okay, Liz Weston, go nuts.
All righty. Tom, are you a W-2 employee or are you a contractor as well?
I'm a W-2.
Okay. And
yeah.
you don't have a retirement plan at work?
No, I don't. We're a very small company and there's no real standard benefits package here.
Okay. All yeah. right.
But you're going down that train to open a Roth.
Yes.
Which
yeah,
is great.
I've already begun largely, you know, because I listen to the show a lot and my 30s are fast approaching, so I want to get it done now.
Well, and yeah, I don't mean to scare people, but really, I mean, by the time you get into your 30s, you're starting to be behind the eight ball with retirement savings. And
sure.
it's really so much easier if you start in your 20s. You know, I'd love to see people start with their first job, but starting at 27 is great.
Yeah.
Max that puppy out. You know, I think you can put in $5,500 this year. She can put
right,
in $5,500.
Right.
Now, that would eat up, you know, that windfall you're expecting to get. But the nice thing about a Roth is if you really need to, you can pull those contributions back out without any penalty, without any taxes. So it's kind of like a cross between an emergency fund and a retirement fund. Now, I would encourage you to leave that money alone if at all possible because, you know, we talked about this before, that every $1,000 you pull out of a retirement account in your 20s is costing you $20,000 down the line.
Really?
So it really pays to leave that money alone if you possibly can. But there are some people whose finances are just so uncertain that they wouldn't contribute to a retirement account otherwise. And this is a way to do it. You can have your cake and eat it too, however you want to look at it. So totally encourage you guys to do that. And then how long do you think, does your wife know how long she wants a maternity leave, how long she wants to take a break?
She right now is figuring on about a year or so.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll see, you know, and we'll see what life gives us in that course of that year. You know, if I make more money, she may stay at home or vice versa. If she has an opportunity, I may be, you know, a stay-at-home dad or that sort of thing. So, but probably a year or so before both of us are to be back in the workforce.
Okay. So, and that's a good idea to stay flexible because you really don't know how you'll feel until the baby is here. Some people who think, I can't wait to take this time off, learn that they can't wait to get back to work. I highly encourage you to, you know, put the money into those Roths and realize you can tap it if you need to, but not necessarily, you know, pull that money out just for daily living.
As far as saving for the child, is there anything you could speak to in regards to that?
Yeah, absolutely. College educations are just going to become more and more important. Just to stay in the middle class, people are going to need to have a college degree. So that's kind of your starting point. I think you guys already appreciate how important it is. So that's something to think about, is that if you can save for your kids' college education, you probably should.
Yep.
People think, oh, I'm going to save and ruin their chances of financial aid. Well, financial aid is mostly loans. So by saving, you're helping your child have less debt. That's all a good thing. What you want to do first, though, is make sure you're on track saving for retirement.
Of course.
And there are a lot of great calculators out there. AARP has a wonderful calculator. T. Rowe Price. There's lots of them out there that you can kind of play with. So get yourself on track for retirement first, and then make that saving for college a top priority.
I think you mentioned 529s when you wrote into us. I mean, the interesting thing about investigating 529s, you know, as a way to save for college is also to look into their tax treatment, what that means in different states, and also attention, grandparents, et cetera. How other people can contribute to them.
529s are a great way for most families to save for college education and hit those grandparents up, man. I mean, don't need one more plastic toy. You need some money in that college fund.
I'll mention it to Grandma this weekend.
Well done.
Great Grandma, I should say.
Well, thank you so much for calling us. I really appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you. Can I ask you one question?
Absolutely.
Could I say, Vanessa, I love you very much. And I can't wait for our baby and our new family.
Oh, man. I'm like a cynic, and you kind of got me, so.
Awesome. Awesome,
okay,
Tom.
Well.
Thank
pleasure.
You.
Take care.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, Liz, we got one more for you. This one is an email from Virginia in Sheffield, Massachusetts. And she came into quite a bit of money, $300,000. She's got a question about what to do with it. Says they're close to 50 years old. They never had this kind of money. Their kids do go to private school. And next year, that could cost them a fair amount of money, either $13,000 or $26,000, depending on whether or not they get financial aid. But they want to know what to do with the money. Retirement, cash it out and reapportion it, and stocks and different funds. How do they protect it while their kids are maybe in college? I mean, this is a fair amount of money to suddenly have responsibility for.
Yeah, absolutely. How old are their kids?
One goes to college in 4 years and the other in 7 years.
Okay.
So they got a little while.
They do. And I think what I'm getting from the between the lines is that they're worried about this affecting their financial aid, right?
I think they're worried about it affecting their financial aid, but also the responsibility that comes with managing money, because Virginia says she's never really had any, and suddenly she feels like she's got to handle it well without, as she put it, any knowledge of what that actually means.
All right. Well, the thing I can confidently suggest that will absolutely help her is to get a fee-only planner to walk her through this process, because, you know, this windfall probably isn't going to happen again. And it's really easy to just blow through money once you get it. You feel rich, you decide you can afford this, you can afford that. And it really helps to have an individualized plan. My suggestion would be to get as much of that money into retirement accounts as possible. The good thing about retirement accounts, not, you know, just funding your future life, but for financial aid formulas do not consider retirement funds. So if she can get that into Roths, if she can, you know, boost her retirement contribution at work and maybe pull money out of the fund for that, that's a good way.
That it doesn't decrease the other picture.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that people should know is that they think their assets, like a windfall like this, is just going to be devastating in financial aid. Financial aid is heavily dependent on your income. So if you have, for example, a six-figure income, the financial
aid— Yeah, they make about $100,000.
Yeah, okay. Well,
together.
The financial aid formula is going to assume they've been saving all along, even if they haven't. So the impact of the assets is not the real issue. It's, you know, how much income do you have? If you make $100,000 and have only one kid in college at a time, which is, sounds like she'll only have two at you know, for 1 year, that, you know, she's not going to be able to expect a lot of aid to start with. So what I wouldn't do is let some insurance salesperson scare you into buying an annuity to, quote, protect this asset, because at this point you don't know how much of a big deal that's going to be. And as I said, if you can get the money sheltered, put it into a retirement account, that's good. Paying down the mortgage is another way to take money that might otherwise be counted in the financial aid formulas that and kind of move it off the table, because the federal formula does not count home equity. Some private colleges do, but the federal formula does not. Mm-hmm. These are all strategies that a fee-only financial planner can walk you through so you understand all of your options.
Liz Weston is a personal finance expert and the author of The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. Liz, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Lizzie.
Filed your taxes, you're in the black, and that big refund is heading your way. Now what?
I think the priority should be saving for retirement first.
Making the most out of what you get back. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. At the end of the year, you may have gotten those envelopes in the mail with save for tax purposes on the front, statements of how much money you made working throughout the year, and, you know, all that stuff you turn over to the IRS for your tax returns. But when you file your taxes says a lot about you as a person and a budgeter. To delve a little deeper into the psychology of taxes and tax refunds, we've got Kelly Phillips-Erb. She's a contributing writer at Forbes.com and created the blog Tax Girl. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about why some people like to get their tax return out the door as soon as they can, and some others are waiting until like April 13th. There are practical reasons, and I think there's probably some psychology back there too. What are the reasons?
Well, the obvious reason is money. If you're expecting a refund, especially a big refund, you're going to want to file as soon as you can, because that means you get your money back quicker. Obviously, if you're one of the folks like me that's going to be writing a check out, you want to delay that as much as possible, because there's, you know, no fun writing a big check in February if you don't have to write it until April.
What kind of advice would you give someone who's trying to figure out, okay, what do I do here? Do I try to get more money in every paycheck? Do I try to get a big refund? How do I look at all of this if I'm kind of surveying the landscape?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, conventional wisdom is that you don't want the big refund. Conventional wisdom has always been that if you're getting a big refund at the end of the year, you're doing something wrong because you don't get interest with your refund. And so the government's had your money all year. And if only you'd made a few adjustments, you could get money, more money throughout the year in your paycheck and, you know, then get less at the end of the year. So it used to be that when people would say, I'm getting a big refund, people kind of looked at them and say, what are you doing wrong? But as economics have changed and as taxpayers are kind of more under the gun, some of the folks, especially in lower income tax brackets, look at a refund as almost like a forced savings account because they know that money's going to be there at the end of the year. So, you know, they're not spending it. If they maybe had an extra $50 in each paycheck, they might be tempted to spend that on stuff they don't need. But then a lot of taxpayers are actually now holding on to this hope that they're going to get a big check and they're going to use it to pay off credit cards, or they're going to use it to pay rent, or, you know, to take up other necessities. So it's really kind of an interesting shift. You know, and again, if you talk to most tax practitioners, they would say, no, don't do the big refund. And I will say that I've always touted that. I've always said you don't want the big refund. But as I've talked to more and more taxpayers, especially this season, and kind of seeing how they've been treating this as, this is money that's going to help me in one lump sum that I know that I wouldn't have saved, it kind of makes sense. So I think that, you know, if you're the kind of person that has an income that lends itself to not, you know, desperately needing a check at the end, then I would absolutely say you want to change your withholding so that you get a little bit back during the year rather than rely on this big check. But as I hear more and more taxpayers and their stories, I'm beginning to understand why some people like the big check.
Tell me about how you've seen this shift in how people think of their refunds play out.
Well, again, traditionally, I've always told taxpayers that they needed to, you know, to adjust the withholding so that they didn't get this big check at the end. But I don't think that the way that the economy has worked, it supports that for all families. And one of the examples is I had this taxpayer who contacted me, and she had had a terrible month with the government shutdown. Her business didn't do well. She made $345 for the entire month of October, and she was used to getting $3,000 a month. But she didn't panic because she knew that she had this big refund coming, and tax season opened in January, and she knew that all she had to do was hang on for a few months. And I think that a lot of taxpayers are getting to think of this that way. This is kind of, you know, their rainy day fund, this pot of money at the end that's going to make it okay if they fall into a hole. Because a lot of taxpayers, quite frankly, like a lot of Americans, are just living paycheck to paycheck. And if one of those paychecks drops out, it creates a real hardship. This notion that, you know, maybe at the end I'll be okay because I have a pot of money to rely on is kind of changing the way people look at refunds.
The big check almost sounds like a psychological game you're rigging to outsmart yourself so that you don't spend it ahead of time.
Absolutely. And a lot of people think of it that way. And again, it was the kind of conversations that I've been having with taxpayers when I say, but isn't it better if you pay $200 each month on your credit card rather than paying it off in one big chunk. And they say to me, but I wouldn't do that if I had the money in my paycheck. You know, because there's always some bill, somebody clamoring, some bill collector looking for their share. So I think it forces people to kind of budget a little where they might not budget throughout the year.
Kelly Phillips Erb is a contributing writer at Forbes.com, and she runs the blog Tax Girl. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
About some of the psychology behind tax refunds, why people file when they do, how a refund can almost be like keeping the money away so you can't spend it until the last minute. But now, if it's here, what do you do? How do you make all that money work for you? We're going to ask those questions to Sharon Epperson. She's the personal finance correspondent for CNBC. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I have to tell you, I think if some people get a refund, they're like, woohoo, yay, I got money from the government. I want to spend it. I know that that's not your reaction. Why can't I just run out and spend it?
No, I don't think you should spend it. First of all, I don't think you should be getting a huge refund check because you need to be monitoring your withholding throughout the year so that you don't get a big refund check and you use that cash for what you need. I would say, first of all, don't try to get that big refund check. But when you get it, definitely don't spend all of it.
So what should I be doing with it then? You know, if someone is getting a refund check, where should their priorities be?
I think the priority should be saving for retirement first. And that might seem really kind of crazy, especially if you're in your 20s and you've got this money and you really just want to go to Cabo and you really just want to have a great vacation and get out of this weather. But the reality is that if you start saving now, it's going to grow so much that when you need it for retirement, you'll be so happy that you did it. So I think the best place to start, if you are in the income level that allows you to do it, is to put that money into a Roth IRA. And the reason why I like a Roth IRA is that it should be earmarked for retirement, but contributions that you put into this account are yours to take out whenever you want. You won't get penalized for it. You won't have to pay taxes on it either. So that is something that is really good to know. And the other thing that I like about a Roth is the fact that when you do take the money out in retirement, you don't pay taxes on it. So that money is continuing to grow, and you're very likely, particularly if you're a younger person, to be in a much higher tax bracket when you retire, and so you won't have to pay the taxes on the money when you take it out.
A lot of young people, a lot of everybody, have debt. But you think it's better to put some of this money aside for retirement first rather than tackling some high interest debt like credit card debt?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's better to do it rather than do that. But I do think that it's important. If you do have that debt, no. You want to pay off the high interest debt because the interest that you are likely paying on that debt is going to be higher than the returns you're going to get on any investments you make in that retirement fund. But I'm just hoping that people are not, you know, getting this huge refund and also having a ton of credit card debt, because you wouldn't have to have that credit card debt, again, if you were adjusting your withholdings to make sure that you had more cash on hand and adjusting your cash flow so that you could pay those credit card bills as they come every month.
So if you get a refund, it's sort of telling you, hey, maybe your budgeting was off. If you get that message, what should you then do?
What you should do is go to your employer and adjust your withholding allowances. Make sure that you are withholding enough and not too much so that you can be able to have cash flow that will allow you to pay your bills, and make sure that you're not racking up credit card debt and not able to pay bills that you need to pay on a monthly basis. So the first step you need to do is really go to your employer and figure out how you can make changes to the withholding.
So you're not saying you don't get to have any fun if you get a refund?
One of my biggest rules in terms of budgeting is that you want to make sure you have some fun money. I'm not saying that you can never take a vacation, that you can't buy the things that you want to buy. Personally, I would take that refund and definitely try to get a couple spa treatments in. But what I'm saying is that you have to make sure that you have your priorities straight. And this bucket of money that's coming, this refund, gives you an opportunity to figure out a little bit of a budget. Maybe you don't budget as well on your monthly bills and day-to-day expenses, but what you can do with this money is take a portion of it, save it, take a portion of it and save it for perhaps a short-term saving, something that might come up in an emergency, and put some of it toward your fun money. So you may want to put the money into a couple different buckets so that you can at least enjoy a little bit of your refund.
Sharon Epperson, personal finance correspondent for CNBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Changing careers can be exciting and terrifying, particularly if you had a fiscally cautious upbringing. This week, an attorney turned activist shares her story of stepping out on financial faith.
Hi, I'm Reshma Sajani. I'm the CEO and founder of Girls Who Code. Girls Who Code is a national nonprofit that's seeking to close the gender gap in technology. Because I think that entrepreneurs starting companies, the technology revolution is really where it's at, and it's going to get more and more strong, and women are not a part of that growth. My father and my mother are both engineers. My parents came here as refugees from Uganda. They're originally from India, and they came here in 1973 to Chicago, Illinois. They came here with, like, no money. Like, $20. They didn't speak the language, they didn't know the culture, they didn't have any friends or family, so they were literally, like, starting out on their own. So they struggled a lot, and money was always a big concern for them.
I think they're a big fan of coupons and deals, which I still am. You know, there's nothing better than a sale and feeling like you're getting something at a discount. But I definitely have gone through periods of rebellion where I feel like I've wasted money just for the sake of it in some ways to probably get back at them. I think they've taught me to be risk averse. That's something that has stuck with me from childhood that I feel like I'm imparting in my organization. We're really conscious of how we spend money and that we save money. You know, we have the resources to take more risks and to do more stuff, but I've really just been much more cautious. And I think that's been a good thing for the organization. And I think a little bit of that slow and steady attitude has been something that my father has really taught me. And they've always put a big emphasis for me and my sister in picking careers where you can actually go make money and support the family. I remember when I went and got my master's in public policy, my parents wouldn't speak to me for a couple of years because they didn't think that politics was, you know, was a profession where I would be really able to support myself. I mean, my father thought, why are you wasting time getting your master's in public policy? You should be going to law school. And they really did cut me off. You know, they wanted a better life for me and my sister. They didn't want me to struggle in the way that I think that they really did when they first came to this country and probably, you know, for several years. I mean, eventually my parents came around and they did come around to my political career. I've really learned that money doesn't make you happy, you know, that you really have to figure out what you want to do with your life. And I guess this is not what my parents taught me. You know, from an immigrant perspective, it's like if you have a safe, secure job, that will bring happiness. And, you know, I chased the safe, secure, finance, legal job for a long time, and it did not make me happy. And now I have a fraction of the money I had, you know, when I was a corporate attorney, and I'm really happy.
Reshma Sajani is the CEO and founder of the tech nonprofit Girls Who Code. Okay, how many ads for flower bouquets have popped up in your Facebook news feeds this week? Or maybe instead you've been bombarded by tweets decrying the oppression of another greeting card holiday. No matter your feelings about romance, social media is not exactly a place where people hold back on expressing themselves. So we've asked Marketplace's digital producer, Raghu Manavalan, to come back on the show and check in on the conversations we've been having with you out on the internet. Hey, Raghu.
Hey, Lizzie.
Valentine's week. Often a point of friction when love and money collide. Anything out there in the Twitter world that was bubbling up? Maybe conflict or happy stuff?
A little of both, you know. Whenever we talk about money and love and romance, things can get difficult. There's always the cheapskate in the relationship, and there's the one that racks up the credit card bills. We're always talking about how do you bring up debt in a relationship? How do you bring up a prenuptial agreement in a relationship? So last week on the show, we asked people to send us their favorite love and money stories that they had in their own lives. And we got this really heartfelt letter from Denise in Arizona, who said that her favorite gifts are the heart-shaped rocks that her boyfriend finds for her when he's hiking out in the wilderness, which I thought was really cute and kind of rugged.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you don't have to always spend the money on the Tiffany's necklace. Sometimes you can just find something that reminds you of your partner.
I love that. I would be very moved by that. So let's shift focus a little bit. My local grocery store in Brooklyn looks like a swarm of locusts came through. People just like buying everything in sight to prepare for
Stormwatch 2014
storm. And we were getting all these social media pictures. What were people telling you?
Well, we threw out this question on Twitter, too. You know, what are you doing to prepare for the snowpocalypse that's apparently occurring on the East Coast? I'm out here in Los Angeles. I'm not sure what you guys are talking about.
Whatever, man.
I may or may not be wearing flip-flops right now. At Akasha Girl said, too much snow plus cold equals stuck inside lots with my toddler. Prepped for this storm with some wine for mommy and then a happy face emoticon. At Pretty Small says she has wine in Sherlock, so everything's all good.
I endorse that.
Yeah, right? So apparently the key to surviving bad weather outside is to drink at home alone.
It's not alone if you're with Benedict Cumberbatch.
That's true.
Let's move on to our freelance life. How the freelance industry By 2020, that number is supposed to grow to half of the workforce. That seems like a huge number.
It's a huge number. Right now, one-third of the workforce is considered contingent workers, which means they're not getting benefits, they're not getting employer matches on their 401k, they don't even know if they're working next week. So if by 2020 this is going to become half of the workforce, this is a big question that might be taking over the economy in the next couple of years. So we're going to be taking these questions all week on our Twitter account, at LiveMoney. We'll be taking these questions all week on our Facebook page. If you want me to set up a Friendster account or something like that, because you have questions about how to handle becoming a freelancer in the next couple of years, I would love to hear them.
That's our social media producer, Raghu Manavalan. Thank you so much, Raghu.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, that's it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time, David Lazarus from the LA Times is here in the chair. He's answering your questions. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Semitovich, Candice Manriquez, John Ketchum, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brennan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in New York. And remember, always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.